Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
With guest co-hosts,
Cajun Lancer. 3, 2, 1, go. I almost said 3, 2, 1, shiny, but I figured I'd confuse you, so I didn't.
Out of my head, I thought shiny.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're at Polycast episode 48, and introducing the participants. I'm starting with myself. I'm Kostas, also known as Kinjin. Daniel.
Known as Dan Q. Hello.
Annalie.
Cardamandua. Hi.
Lance. And Makalua.
Hello.
We also have an interviewee for the first part of this episode, Karch. We'll get to that shortly. But first, a question to him. Since you are appearing on Polycast, have you ever listened to the show before?
Yeah, I have. I can't remember which show it was, though. I think it was a holiday show.
Girls Playing Civ.
you think that was it?
Yeah, that's got to be.
It was the best.
That one was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Because you guys were just going totally nuts.
I haven't seen the numbers for it, but I think it's probably the most popular Polycast ever.
Is that right?
It was probably really was the most fun to make, though. It was fun.
For some people.
Not Dan, who had to edit all that.
Dan was upset because all he got to do was listen. He just listened the whole time. He didn't even say anything.
Oh, he didn't get to make himself look smart.
No.
No, I just looked smart through the editing. That's all.
And there was a lot of editing involved in that one.
Uh-oh.
As Mackie said, yeah, it is the most popular. Adjusted for some odd craziness that we've seen in the stats for the first episode. My gosh, it's been more than 6 months now. It's still
getting downloads, huh?
It's still getting downloads. It's still getting new listeners or people who downloaded it before and deleted it and then went, why? Why did I delete that? It sounded like women were talking to me. No. We speak with recent Novice Play champion Ken Kart Bodicher on a Poulton Civilization IV Beyond the Sword Tri-League Tournament Series in the first of a two-part interview, the second to follow in a future episode. At the news desk, several previews of Civilization IV Colonization reveal some new details about this, quote, standalone expansion, unquote, coming to PCs this fall. In forum talk, armored units have had their collateral damage ability removed in the new 3.17 patch for Beyond the Sword. Good or bad? And is the Barrage promotion broken? Then in the Senate, switch to free religion as soon as it becomes available, and research feudalism or engineering first.
Welcome to an interview segment where we hold conversations with key individuals in the Civ community.
On a Poulton Civilization site, we have the Beyond the Sword Tri-League Tournament. We have novice level, intermediate, and advanced. There are different games posted every month, too, in fact, and you have a chance to see if you are the best, or at least don't suck.
I would.
If you happen to be one of the winners in either of the leagues, again, novice, intermediate, or advanced, then not only do you get an Poulton Plus subscription for 3 months in advance, 2 months in intermediate, or one at novice, but for the next round of the tournament, you also get a custom forum title that says you are the reigning champion. We have with us a recent novice league champion, Karch, who in something called Real Life goes by Kenneth Bodicher. So, Ken, tell us about the Tri-League in general terms.
Well, it's actually a very interesting tournament. It's kind of like a duplicate tournament. The people who put together the tournament create a save game, and they upload that to the forum, and then everyone has a chance to download it and play it through, and when you're done, you upload the results. The person with the best adjusted score wins. everybody's playing the same game, and they take care when they're creating the game to make sure it'll be interesting, make sure you have resources that are useful to you, make sure it's going to be challenging at the same time. Kind of like reminds me of Duplicate Bridge, where everybody's playing the same thing.
You mentioned adjusted score. How is that differing from score?
That's a good question. Civ has two scores when you finish a game, and the raw score is what you get based on territory that you've conquered and what your population is and what your army size is and things like that. And the adjusted score is adjusted based on the difficulty, the size of the map, and some other factors. I don't remember all of them.
Can they judge? Is there a fudge factor? Is doing amazing things get you any further along the whole thing?
I don't think so. I think they just go by the raw adjusted score of that Civ gives you. I can't remember them actually giving anyone a win based on doing something crazy.
If you send them up to the next level, it's a try, right?
That's a really good question. I was actually, when I got started, I started in the intermediate level, and I got my butt kicked repeatedly. And I decided I better drop back down to the novice level. And that's another thing that's actually nice about the tournament is that the organizers are good about letting you switch difficulties if you feel like you need to. I've actually been trying in a couple of the intermediate games recently to see if I would do okay, and it's still kicking my butt. So I'm probably going to stay at the novice level for now.
It's nice to win. That's why I'm pushing through. In that level.
Knows how to click level.
What are your reasons for entering the tournament in the first place, and why do you continue to participate?
The reason that I entered in the first place was I'm kind of a serial restarter when it comes to playing Civ. I get going in a game, and then things don't go the way I like, so I go back a few turns and try again. I decided that I would like a little bit more of a challenge, and one of the interesting things about the tournament games is that you're not allowed to do that. You have to play them straight through without restarting at all. We're basically on the honor system to make sure that we do that, but they say they have ways of detecting if you've gone back and cheated. I wouldn't know about anything about that. But anyway, I decided to join the tournament to give myself that extra challenge, and I had been playing at Prince level. And the intermediate games are at Monarch, if I remember right. So I wanted to kind of, like, push myself a little bit. I was just interested in the competition. As far as why I continue playing, it's just been a really interesting series of games. The guys have put together the tournament, and they do a really great job of coming up with different interesting scenarios and sort of mixing up the leaders that you come up against, all different kinds of maps and settings for the maps. So you get to play things that you wouldn't normally play unless you're, like, really into variety, into doing a lot of different things with Civ yourself.
The organizers of the Tri-League are Matt Newgog, who has been on Polycast before, as well as Rob Warham, who has a username called Rob Warham, real original. Not that I have much ground to stand on.
Yeah.
And yes, the intermediate games are at Prince difficulty, Advanced at Emperor, and Novice at Warlord.
Is there a favorite strategy you follow, or do you have a dynamic way to play its game?
I like to rapidly expand. That's kind of the only constant strategy that I follow is that. I like to explore as much as possible, find out who my nearest neighbors are, and expand towards them as quickly as possible. That's kind of the only constant strategy. Apart from that, I'll adjust it dynamically based on what leader I have, what the terrain looks like, whether I think I can get early religions or not, those kinds of things. But usually it's expanding towards my nearest enemy as my basic goal in the beginning of the game.
So do you prefer a warlike game or a more diplomatic?
I like the peaceful games better. The main reason is I tend to get bogged down with long wars. I haven't quite mastered the art of making peace and then rebuilding and going back to war again. When I get into a fight, I want to drag it out until one side is, you know, reduced to rubble. That can really wipe out your game if you get in against a defensive leader or something. You end up spending all of your resources on armies and end up losing in the long run. For some reason, I just focus in on that. And so if things are going a little bit more peacefully, I'm better able to concentrate on keeping the empire going rather than just going to war and killing things.
Well, you prefer a more builder style.
Yeah. In fact, I don't think I've had a conquest victory at all. All of my victories have been either space race or diplomatic.
Oh, okay, so you have one. I was about to say, I don't know if we have any more room for builders on the show, but you win, so, okay.
A lot of my success has been, to quote Woody Allen, just showing up. You know, Woody Allen famously said 80% of success is just showing up. A lot of the games that I've won, well, not a lot of them, a couple of them that I've won, I was the only one who turned in a save game. I tried to fix that problem by going to a couple of websites where I have some friends and drumming up a little support for the tournament. I think I had maybe 4 or 5 new people to join in the last few games, which is good because it's really never fun to win playing against yourself. But a lot of the other games, people will finish them, and then I find this to be true, especially in the novice bracket. They'll finish them and then just won't bother turning in the game because they're embarrassed because they lost or whatever. But people that are participating have to remember that even if you lose, nobody else wins, and you have the best loss. You're going to win your free month of Apollicon membership, so it's worth turning it in. The other thing that's nice about this is that you get to play at your own pace. I mean, if I have a lot of spare time, I can just blast through a game really quickly. There was a game a few games back where I did that. I just played it, I think it was in 2 sessions, maybe a 6-hour session and a 3-hour session, and I was done. And then there's other games where I'll keep putting it off, but you can just totally go at your own pace, and it makes it a lot easier to have fun. And I wouldn't have thought that a competition where you're not really seeing your competitors could be all that great, but it turns out to be good. End up having some lively discussions after the games. Not so much in the novice category, because I think a lot of the novices think that they don't really have anything to say. But I like reading the advanced and intermediate discussions, too, because they play similar maps. They're not exactly the same, but they're similar in layout.
So if there was one thing that you could suggest to Rob and Matt with regards to the Trilog that you would like to see changed, added, deleted, what would it be, if anything?
As a completely selfish request.
The best kind.
I would want the difficulty moved up one notch, because I honestly think that the Warlord difficulty is a little bit too easy for me, but Prince difficulty is still too hard, as I've found after trying some of the intermediate games. So they say in the league rules that the difficulty levels are approximate, but I don't think that they've actually tried different difficulty levels. But on a more serious note, some of the scenarios they come up with are just really way out there. Like, when you have multiple rulers from the same country and there's espionage going on, it's impossible to tell who the espionage is coming from. Like, if you have spies in your territory that are destroying improvements, the message you get from the game is, England has destroyed farm. And when there are 2 different rulers from England, you don't know who to go after. I found that very maddening. Because I like to get even with people who are sending spies after me. That said, they do just a really outstanding job of keeping a lot of variety in the matches and different map types, which I really enjoy playing all the different map types.
Exactly. That's why we keep them around. Did I say that out loud? Uh-oh.
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
Civilization 4 Colonization. Written by Dan Stapleton for PC Gamer US, that's the Games Radar article. Just looking specifically at what's new in terms of what we hadn't known before. Colony management is heavily automated by default, but you can micromanage each colonist's job assignment. Any colonist can be assigned to any profession, but trained masters get bonuses. Jason Ocampo over at IGN says the game will feature randomly created maps, just like Civilization, and it's up in the air whether historically accurate maps will be included.
Please.
Okay. There's my pitch.
They should be included. Isn't that important? I mean, wouldn't that be critical that we have a map of the New World?
Yeah, at the very least, we have to have the map of the Americas.
This next point had me kind of going, ooh, a little bit, which was much of the game will involve the trade mechanism of sailing ship going back and forth between New World and Old World.
It's what it did before.
Yeah, I didn't actually play much of the original colonization, which might be going part to that, but we'll see. We'll see. How you deal with your monarch will affect the end game, because your goal is to eventually throw them off and establish independence from them. If you comply with their requests, you'll stay friendly but poor. If you resist, you'll find yourself saddled with higher taxes or more troops stationed in your territory. Make sense? And, of course, for those familiar with the original colonization, either through reading it and or playing it, some of this may not be new to you at all. It's just like, oh, well, same old, but getting everybody on the same page, hopefully. The GameSpy article goes first to go into detail with regards to what happens after you declare independence. You get a series of either or question pop up immediately after you declare independence, the collective results of which will comprise your nation's constitution. Will you support slavery, enforce the separation of church and state, model yourself after monarchist rulers, or opt for a representative democracy? Each of these elements will bestow certain global properties on your colony. Also, you can freely engage in trade or enact treaties with any groups you encounter, native or colonist, and there are skills that can only be taught to your units by native cultures. The furrier trade, for example, can only be taught by the Incan Empire.
They did the same thing in the first colony. That was great.
Yeah, you could get some trained skills by hiring specialists in from the old world, but some things you can only pick up in the new world.
I forget how you get them, though. In 10 years...
You sent an untrained colonist or indentured servant to the Indian village, and then they would teach them. They only do it once, though.
Nigel Lopez was on GameSpy, and then the big download over at David Craddock. I'd never actually visited this site before or heard of this site before. Unlike most other strategy games, any unit in Civ 4 Colonization can be upgraded to any other type of unit, but not instantly. You have to train them first. A unit's previous training does have an impact on the success he'll find in future jobs. They provide the example of double-clicking on a settler, choosing fishermen from the list of upgrade choices, and letting him work for a bit before moving him to a flat tile and then converting him into a farmer, where that career switch worked out for the better since the two lines of work weren't too dissimilar in their requirements.
That's interesting.
Yeah, why not? That should almost be brought into Civilization V, because, you know, you can train somebody to do anything.
You can make defensive pacts and treaties with Native Americans. I'm not sure if that was in the original or to what extent it was.
Well, you could ask them to help you, I think, against the king, but it depended on how your overall relation with the tribe was. There wasn't individual treaties or anything.
No. If you encroach on their land, they might go to war with you. However, if your relationship with them is strong, they might simply give you their villages as your borders expand. Is that new?
They would sometimes not complain if you took over land, but eventually they would get really ticked off if they were, like, totally surrounded. Even if they liked you, they'd be like, hey, hey. So that's a positive change. Made no sense that if you were there on the coast and you had otherwise peaceful relations, you had one village that would be totally, completely alarmed and everybody else was all just relaxed because you'd end up having to go to war or something with them because of that one village.
I wonder how historically accurate that is. They're just giving you their villages? That's odd.
Yeah, I don't know about the historical accuracy of that. May have made that to make it easier for the player's gameplay, but I don't know about that.
Yeah, I'm not going to go over to my neighbor's house and say, would you like my house? You know, not going to happen.
I don't know, maybe it's a reflection of the more peaceful tribes who decided, look, we're just going to move west because you people, oh, God.
It's not different than giving you their village.
Yeah.
If you give them their village, can you turn it into a city or something?
Yeah, we need more details on that, Dan.
That's all we've got right now. With regards to the rebel sentiment, it's once you reach 50%, you can start a revolution. The revolution screen also shows what forces you have and what forces your opponent has. Was it a 50% thing in the original, too?
I don't recall, but I know you would have enemy forces develop from within your own land as loyalists, I suppose.
Yeah, each of your cities had a meter as to how much rebel and how much imperial they were, sort of. And head more towards the people that were wanting to be independent side of the rebels, then the city would produce more and you wouldn't have that problem with having enemy forces come out. But if you had, you know, like your younger cities that hadn't developed as much, sometimes you'd have them try to rebel and go back to the home country, or they'd at least spew out partisans that would come attack you from the other side.
I think historically New York had a lot of rebels, whereas like Montreal had none. That's a shot at DQ.
After declaring a revolution, you get to form your constitution. If you pick slavery, it will increase the production in all your cities. Choose monarchy, you will be allowed to have continued trade with Europe, although we probably assume not the European power.
Right.
You know.
Not the home country.
In this particular preview, an unnamed representative from 2K is quoted specifically. They say they have included everything that's in the actual American Constitution. You have to decide what way you're going to go on that. I like his comment about, you don't have to battle naval units, just ground units. Of course, if you destroy ships before they can land and deploy troops, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Really?
Destroy that man of war full of cavalry before they get here.
Finally, in previews over at 1UP from Thierry Nguyen, we talked about the mechanism of back and forth between the New World. Each trip to Europe takes 2 turns, so your ship is out of commission for at least 4 turns when you decide to go back to each direction, so something to be considered. And each home country and its 2 leaders have a special set of traits, and the French traits lend themselves to positive relations with Native Americans.
Yep. They didn't have multiple leaders, but that was the French traits from before.
So what's the similarities with Civilization 4? Apart from, let's say, they use the engine of Civilization 4, but at what extent, apart from the graphics, do we know anything? Do we have the same resource system, the same military?
No, they really haven't gone into detail about what units we're going to have or exactly the resources. You'd have to look up on the original colonization to get an idea.
I'm hoping for some modern armor.
If it gets that far, you're in trouble.
Well, just give me one. Thinking about the original colonization, I had developed one of my strategies came to mind from 10 years ago, which doesn't happen too often. I would try to limit the amount of cities that I would build on the ocean because it would limit the amount of places that the English could land. And, and so I kind of knew which way they were coming from if I did that.
Yeah, you'd have like 2 or 3 port cities and everything else would be inland. So, you know, there's only 2 or 3 places they would land.
Exactly.
And therefore you could make them the big, fully developed stone wall forts and stack them with cannons and cavalry.
Yeah, and all the inland city had only good intentions to defend it.
Yep.
Got news? Email news@apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Lacutis, or one of the other news editors.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Tanks are direct fire weapons. Well, tanks are direct fire weapons. I mean, you can use them as indirect fire weapons, and they could, as an indirect fire weapon, cause collateral damage, but they don't have a lot of the advantages that artillery has as being set up for that purpose. I mean, artillery can deliver rounds on target with relative reliability, whereas tanks kind of just park on a hill and raise their gun and blast away. So tanks causing collateral damage, tanks should cause a direct fire damage to the unit that they're attacking, but I would say that collateral damage is not a good idea.
I agree there. Otherwise, if tanks have that, in addition to also having blitz, for example, or being able to attack multiple turns and the fact that they can go down the city raider path, if they also had the ability for collateral damage, then we just have a whole bunch of stack of tanks and modern armors, and some might be upgraded along certain paths for others, but they'd all be tanks. Why would we have our artillery? Where would be our mobile artillery, for instance? Then there's no reason to actually think. It's just, okay, modern era, tanks, tank, tank, tank.
Right. It lets out combined arms.
We got tanks at 28 strength, modern armor at 40. They both have 2 movement points. They don't receive defensive bonuses, but as I said, they begin with the blitz promotion. That's true. That's a pretty big thing, starting with blitz, because for any other unit to get there, it has to have combat 3 as well as military science. Combat 3 is a bigger one to get as opposed to military science. I mentioned City Raider, and one individual here, he said that he thinks tanks ought to get collateral damage, but why should they get City Raider? He's saying maybe it would be better to allow Marines to have City Raider and tanks only combat and barrage lines. It would make it so the tanks aren't so dominant but still give access to a modern-era City Raider unit.
That makes a lot of sense. Tanks historically, and that's kind of my bugaboo, you know, history, because these things come from history. Tanks historically, once they get into cities, they're just, you can kill them, no problem.
I think that's a fair point as well to look at. Whatever the solution is, we definitely don't want one particular unit to be everything to everybody. He says that he doesn't agree with the combined arms theory way of looking at it. but I think you could have someone that would agree that, yes, they ought to have collateral damage, but not get City Raider, and you still need Combined Arms 3, a way of looking at it. If Marines, for example, had City Raider and tanks did not, maybe you would actually want to diversify the units that you're using to attack. Actually, if Marines had City Raider, whereas tanks did not, I might actually have a reason to build Marines, because I don't at this point, hardly ever. Very situational.
Do you make it that far in the game?
Yes.
Sorry.
At times. And no, I don't do an advanced start thing. No. I actually make it that far, yes.
I don't know that much about Marine training, except that they're amphibious. They're there to hit the beach. That's what their thing is. That should be their predominant goal. I don't know if they do a lot of city training, whereas the regular army does a lot of city training combined with their other training. Also, there are special units that are focused on city. And that's what had developed in World War II was more than currently, I think, was special units that were trained to go through cities and fight in them. Marines, I don't think that's their thing any more than armor. Tanks are for getting in, blitzing, getting in behind, cutting supply lines. This is one of the major things that TIV is seeing so far. Cutting supply lines, isolating the units, and weakening their defensive capabilities that way. Once supply lines are cut, units just tend to evaporate.
I think with the Beyond the Sword patch and the latest one and tanks having their collateral damage removed, which I actually didn't realize, the only thing I saw mentioned in the change log for 3.17 is that it fixed the barrage promotion error. Didn't even know what that was talking about. Given how powerful tanks are and modern armor is, from a gameplay perspective, I can see the removal of collateral damage capability, but for reasons stated, perhaps it would be better if they kept that and they got rid of City Raider, and definitely having both is making it so that it's much too powerful line of units, the armored units. There's a lot of realism discussion in there, but of course it all comes back to gameplay balancing, or at least it ought to.
Yeah, but if you want to have it be a green jello with pineapple chunks that can do this and that and the other thing, that's fine. But if you're going to put a picture of a tank there, it should behave like a tank. But gameplay does come into it, certainly. But I'm on the historical side.
What about orange jello?
Orange jello is just too powerful. The broad promotion, is it broken? I don't know what they're actually referring to, but as a concept, I was kind of considering it.
Well, that thread is basically just saying that he's done a number of tests and has got all these statistics. Basically, it's proving that the barrage promotions don't do anything. They don't change your end results. I don't really know enough. I don't look into that well enough to actually know if he's right or not.
So what you're saying is talking about how the barrage promotion doesn't actually promote anything.
Right.
Yeah, that against other units promoted otherwise. What you're getting in terms of benefit is typically negated by a comparable unit with other promotions, such as City Raider, for instance, and Drill.
Right. But I don't know enough to know whether or not it has any basis in reality. It probably does. It looks like he did his test. Well, there are lots of numbers, so I assume it's right.
You do things the same way I do. It's like, oh, numbers, must be right.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I can't read the numbers.
The thread was started at the end of May, and it's already over 11 pages. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, it's a huge debate.
Civ 4 and the indirect fire barrage stuff, where you bring 25 catapults and blast the heck out of stacks and all that sort of stuff.
It makes conquering go very quickly. Especially if you have to go up against a target that's like at 100% or more culture, and they've got city walls and they've got a castle, and instead of it being just a complete slaughter on both sides, at least evens it out when you have to go against a really hard target.
Yeah, you're actually trying to take that target as opposed to just annoy it. Don't leave home without your siege weapons, whatever level you're at.
So, Firaxis came up with the barrage as an answer to stacks. Do you think it was a good one?
I think it was reasonable given the circumstances. I think there's room for further consideration, such as we were getting at having tanks get rid of the City Raider line instead. But as it is, I think it's reasonable.
So would you take it to Civ 5 just the way it is?
I think when it comes to Civ 5, I would look at possibly putting collateral damage back and taking City Raider out. The fact that it doesn't have both now, it's a good answer. I just don't know if it's the best one.
Sounds good. the Beyond the Sword game, diplomacy game. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of interesting stuff going on with very experienced players in the teams. So I would suggest that people jump in if they can, you know, to different teams. And even if they just throw in an idea here or there or a concept or whatever, like I'm doing, I'm mostly just learning from my teammates there the different way people play. From what Ken was saying earlier about the fun aspect of the game and not getting too much into the mathematics of it, I'm learning how that's done. I've never really done that. I've just gone after it. So there's a lot of opportunity to see the way different people play the game. And so I would just suggest that people go there and get in a team and have some fun and enjoy.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Switch to free religion as soon as possible. Well, I usually don't. I stay to theocracy, and I switch to free religion pretty later often.
Oh, but you will switch to it just later.
Yeah, but, for the science effect, but later, because I prefer personally theocracy for military, you know, for the bonus they give.
What would you say is the advantage of...
The experience, the added experience.
What's the advantage of switching to free religion?
Free religion gives you plus one happy per religion in a city, and as Costas mentioned, plus 10% research in all your cities. Available at liberalism with a low upkeep.
So 10% is, what's the downside to it?
None.
None really, honestly, because if you have a lot of neighbors of different religions, it's actually beneficial to switch to a little earlier because it eases your relations with everybody.
Yeah, that's true.
Instead of everything, oh, heathen, get her, you know.
But now, if you have a religion yourself and you switch to free religion, isn't that inviting a bunch of other heretics and such?
Yeah, but actually having more different religions is beneficial because you can build your culture up a lot easier. Sure, they can send in missionaries to your cities, but it, in the end, it's going to turn out to your benefit.
Yeah, I think really the downside to free religion is simply not something specifically about free religion, but what is it in another religion civic that you are giving up in order to go over to free religion? For example, with organized religion, if you have your state religion in a particular city, then your buildings are constructed 25% faster. That's the primary reason for me that I will not switch to free religion, hardly ever, actually. Now, there is the argument, well, at some point, Dan, if you're really lasting that long in the game, what do you have left to build? That's just buildings, and that's not units. Why wouldn't you have the plus 10% research in the city? Well, I'm typically finding that if one of my founded religions, or if my only found one, if it's dominating, or there is a dominating religion that has spread to me, and that particular civilization or civilizations is stronger than me militaristically, I tend to prefer having slightly better relations with them. And I also find that, speaking single player specifically, that quite a few civilizations after a while, they will switch to free religion. So any negative that I had not being their religion is negated as soon as they switch over to free religion. Now, that's not all games. That's not all particular leaders. And
Isabella.
I randomize traits all the time, so it's kind of like, it could be anybody, it could be nobody. Of course, the science boost, it's all scientific method. I'm liking having that 10% boost with my monasteries.
Still, I got to agree, there's a massive downside to switching to free religion, then, if you lose everything from the other civic that you're giving up. I got to agree with you, Dan, those 25% production bonus and such the like, that's big.
Silly people, that's what factories are for.
Later on in the game, there can be the argument that, well, the plus 25%, what's that really going to get you relative to once you have factories, for example? The other consideration with organized religion is that if you don't have a monastery in a particular city, you can continue to build missionaries. Then you may wonder, well, at that point, by the time free religion comes around, is there really any lots of spreading of religion going on? Isn't it pretty entrenched? I guess that comes back to me, to whatever religion I am, whether I founded it or it's dominating from religions from someone else that's spread. What I like to do is to have so that my relations with those heathen civilizations... You knew that was going to come up, that my relations are as good enough as I can make it with them in the hope that they are not at theocracy so that, in fact, I can take my missionaries and spread them into theirs and hope that they'll switch. or at the very least, if that doesn't work, that they will soon switch to free religion. For example, in trade negotiations, if I have liberalism and they don't, and their religion that I'd rather them not be, either they need to come over to mine or they need to switch over to free religion, then I will hand them liberalism at times and hoping that, oh, please, switch.
Good strategy, too.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I'll stick with my organized religion for the majority of the game until the very end modern era when I don't necessarily need that bonus anymore. Then I'll go to free religion.
Feudalism or engineering? It's a poll, in part, which is which do you usually tech first, generally speaking? Is it engineering or feudalism? Engineering is currently leading the poll, strangely enough, with 100 voters exactly. So 61% here means 61 voters, and 39% meaning 39 voters for engineering and feudalism, respectively. Diamond Eye asks, which do you usually go for first? I'm with Diamond Eye and the majority here. I'm going with engineering first. For me, since Beyond the Sword, because of castles, how does it take very long for castles to go away? As soon as I am able to research engineering, I'd like to grab that so that I can get started on my castles so they can be as effective as possible for as long as possible. The Notre Dame Wonder is nice, but do I have a city that I can afford to have building that? Because by that point, I'm starting to worry about the safety of my empire. I'm starting to look too tasty, typically. But the plus one road movement is also big for me, but it's being able to build the castle, having espionage ability, because before that, it actually might be more of a 50-50 for me, which of the technologies I would go for first. Because it's true with feudalism, you get longbowmen, and I like upgrading my archers as soon as possible to those. I would still go, especially post Beyond the Sword, with engineering.
It's more expensive to research engineering.
Yes, that's true. 1,000 beakers versus 700. But despite the higher cost, I still believe it's worth going for first.
Maybe the cost is higher because it's worth going for.
The other nice thing that engineering does is it leads to chemistry, which will get you both frigates and privateers, which I find particularly helpful for sea-based defense, assuming you have a map that would reasonably support that.
In that thread they were talking about, a lot of people don't go for either. They just trade for them.
I'd be curious to know which they would like to trade for first.
Valid point. Apparently engineering.
I don't care that much for feudalism compared to engineering.
But longbows.
Well, crossbows are better.
Yeah, I know. It just depends on which one is easier to get to and am I lagging behind or not.
Right.
It's kind of a situational thing. Sometimes you go for feudalism, sometimes you go for engineering.
Yeah, it really depends on the game, as everything does.
Everything in this game depends on the game.
That's true. Generally speaking, I would go for engineering before feudalism. Just because if we just said, oh, well, it's situational, then the show could get pretty boring.
Well, I know, I'm just...
You ever do anything just because you feel like, hey, what the hell, I'm in the mood to go for feudalism?
And... I'm feeling very feudal today.
Yes, exactly.
I want to beat some serfs today. That feeling comes on occasionally, yes.
Especially during polycast.
Other than the cost of engineering, the biggest negative against engineering is that it gives you trebuchets. What a useless piece of...
Dan, calm down.
Oh, I'm going to my happy place. Girls playing soon.
You knew that was coming.
Today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at polycast@apolton.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show, Modcast, or about Polycast in general,
log into the series' official website at polycast.apolton.net.
The Do You Care thread by Desert Fox. Of course, all these things that the AI cares about, the question is you as a player, do you care about them?
No.
Those being... The religion the rival has, he or she has your favorite civic, years of peace with you, close borders, trading with your worst enemy, has vassals, years of peace with him or her, trade relations were fair and forthright, he or she didn't give you tribute help, he or she voted for you, and he or she declared war on your friend. My first question is, years of peace with you and years of peace with him and her, why are those two separate items? Am I missing something?
Maybe it's saying, did you declare war on them or did they declare war on you? I'm not sure, though. That was just the benefit of the doubt for them.
For me, of those ones on the list that I actually do care about would be years of peace with them. I'll combine those two together. Trade relations, whether or not they did or didn't give me tribute or help, and then what religion the rival has. But as for the others, I really don't care much about them.
There you go.
Well, I care about the things you said, plus the voted for you. I'm very vindictive. They didn't vote for me. Oh, they're going down. What? You didn't vote for me? Are you kidding me?
And if we have close borders, that's because you're building too close to my territory.
Exactly. It's like, if you had stayed back, we would have been fine.
Did you notice how it was the women on the panel? Very territorial.
We discussed this in a prior episode, thanks.
Yeah. I think we have very distinct playing styles, and emotions pull into it.
He or she voted for you, that has to do with a woman's scorned, right? You don't do that.
That's right. So the other thing, I mean, are you going to really go look through all... Oh, you don't have my favorite civic? Oh, you jerk. No, I don't care, though. Really. There's some women, I'm sure, that are controlling enough that they're like, you should do everything the way I want you to do it, but I don't care that much.
Feel free to run slavery. I'll just run emancipation right next door to you.
That's right.
He...
And then I make up things like, my people love me better than they love you, so, I mean, that counts, right?
My color is shinier than yours.
That's right.
How many days of work school have you missed because of Siv?
My answer is none.
Yeah.
None either.
Well, that's boring.
Well, I've been amazingly ineffective on some days of work in school because it's sick, I haven't missed them.
Yeah.
You're there in body, but your mind is in the game.
I'm there in body, but my mind is asleep.
Yeah.
Oh, recovering from.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm with Maki on that one. It's one more turn. It's 3 a.m, what?
And I have to get up at 6? Oh, crap.
Yeah, gotta love it.
Thanks for listening to Polycast episode 48, and thanks everybody who's here. Start with Dan again. Dan, thanks for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for being here. I love being first.
Costas, thanks for being here, pal.
Sure.
Thank you. Brother Mandua.
Thanks, bye.
And, oh, good grief.
Every time.
Makalua.
Almost. Makalua. He's very close. He's closer than most people.
I was gonna say, it's her own fault. She chose her name.
Hey, did not.
Costas did the introduction, so...
Dan gets to do the outro because he's evil and making us Americans work on a holiday weekend.
You guys are working on a holiday weekend for nothing, so who's truly crazy?
Oh, he's got us there.
What? We're not getting paid for this?
Well, it's still making us work on a holiday weekend, so there.
Imran had it right. He just took off. God.
You're smarter than the rest of us. Oh, no.
Oh, we're not going to admit that we just said that about him.
I actually don't have anything scripted as far as this introduction to you goes, so I might butcher it terribly and then edit it in post-production, and I'll sound brilliant.
So normal standard operating procedure, then?
Yeah, pretty much.
Ken Bonnager.
Thank you, Bodicher. Thank you for saying that before I tried to pronounce it. I do appreciate that. I could have just asked you that straight, but I figured this was more entertaining.
Further proof that Dan is secretly evil.
Oh, so we switched topics now, haven't we?
Oh, why not?
That was going nowhere.
Oh, I don't know. Was the first time guest? Is he allowed to say that?
I'm feeling pretty lenient today. My brain's not working today.
I have years like that.
Stop.
Topic? Anyone?
Record date?
July 5th, 2008.
Sound Clips Copyright Association 4 and the Warlords and Meow and the Sword Expansion Packs. Copyright 2008, Appleton Civilization site at appleton.net.